I'll have what she's having.
As many of you know, I am a great fan of tap dance. It's a rare day that I don't either put on my tap shoes or end up watching tap dancing in some form. At my very first tap class when I was in high school and able to avoid gym class by going to a local college for dance class, during that first tap class, it was my friend Annie, myself, and a rangy crew of various ages. And the teacher said, gesturing as demonstration at the gray older fellow at my left, that tap was a dance style that you can do all your life. And I do, and I will. How is tap dance related to sex and getting older? Well, you can do it alone or with a partner. It's fun, but also keeps you physically active. Since it is fun, the fact that it's good for you isn't the point. Practice is also pleasure. Musical accompaniment, optional, often pleasant. Dance, like sex, is a use-it-or-lose-it activity, keeping you able to do more of it. Both are good for your brain. Doing it the same way every time leads not only to dulled sensitivity, but to a yearning for new steps. Unless you're a rockette, doesn't really matter how good you are, as much as that you enjoy it. Also, people giggle when you tell people you do it, especially as you get older. Style comes to matter more than appearance. That's sensual and creative. As for whether it's a performance art, well, there are those, and let's leave it to them, who would rather do it in public, but most of us, prefer it alone or with a very private audience. Also, when you walk into a room and think, "I'd tap that," you could be referring to the hardwood floor or to a potential partner. I come from an activist ancestry. Rule changers, paradigm shifters, protesters, standers up for principle. It is activists who make us aware of uncomfortable inequities and move our consciences as they stir our consciousness. Our guest, Harold Kudin, PhD, has lived an interesting span of history. He was arrested as a young teen for being gay, was widowed by AIDS, and is now married and involved with advocacy for GLBT elders. Kudin is a clinical psychologist, a founder of the National Gay and Lesbian Health Foundation, the author of a book, Golden Men, The Power of Gay Midlife, and he serves on the National Leadership Council of SAGE. Hello, Harold.
Good morning.
What did you dream of growing up to do?
I was programmed to be a physician. My first real toy was when I was 5 and got a doctor's kit.
We all had one of those, didn't we? But I didn't use mine. You used yours?
Yes, because I had an uncle who was a physician, a dead uncle who died in medical school. My aunt was married to a physician, and my grandfather was a physician on my mother's side. I was programmed.
You were programmed. And what did you end up doing?
Had a class in psychology and was absolutely fascinated. And one of the teachers and I got into a conversation, and I was very blunt. I said, "You know, I really am not particularly interested in all of the physical aspects, and I want more sociology and anthropology and more political." And she said, "Well, there happens to be a department in the University of Chicago." I was living in Chicago at the time, and that answers all of those, and you would be going for a PhD in psychology, which at that point frightened me much more than the idea of becoming a physician. I mean, I kind of knew that I could become a physician, which meant just memorizing a lot of things, but actually doing a PhD, that meant being creative.
Yeah.
And that I found that much more frightening. But I went there for an interview and loved the program and transferred and stayed there till I got my doctorate.
That's wonderful. How old are you now?
I'm 79 now. This is my 80th year.
And you're married?
Yes.
How long have you guys been married?
Well, actually married just about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
We got married the week it became legal in New York State.
You did.
We've been together since 2001. we both were gay widowers. Uh-huh. We both had buried our long-term lovers, died of complications from AIDS.
Mm-hmm. Legal gay marriage, of course, is new. You took advantage of being able to go immediately and do it when it became legal.
In my home state. My husband, John, wanted it long, long before. He was willing to go to Canada. And I said, I'm not going to do it until I can do it in where I live.
Yeah. When you and I were born, that was not in the cards.
Not at all. And actually, it never was a fantasy of mine.
Mm-hmm.
I've been an activist since the 60s. And I actually was not one of the people who was, you know, big on the gay marriage, simply because I felt it was hiding the real issue, which was dealing with discrimination and poverty and racism.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt gay marriage would benefit a very small group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And the bigger issues wouldn't have been dealt with.
How do you feel about that now?
I still feel that way. We are married. It's very, to me, marriage is about a commitment. It's about a social recognition of a relationship. It's about a societal knowledge about how committed we are to each other. And then we actually had our big wedding with the families. We had all the families coming, you know, to the wedding. And it for me may sound a little strange, but it was like finally I was having the memorial service while I was still alive.
Oh.
I had gone through the whole, you know, I've been very involved with AIDS work, and you know, every day for a year, 2 years, somebody I knew died.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to so many memorial services where blood family and friends met for the first time, and people met and they kept saying, oh, why didn't we do this while so-and-so was alive? And so for us, my wedding was, that was our memorial. Everyone who was important to us was there.
That's very profound. Do you find that now that we have the availability of legal gay marriage, that it is changing our conception of marriage?
No, I don't think it's changing the conception of marriage. I think it's just been a shock to a lot of people that there are a lot of gay men and women who want marriage and see it in the same breath or the same way that a lot of non-gays do.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, I think you have to sort of set a difference between those of us who see us as being on the cutting edge or those who are sort of assimilationists and sort of say, well, we're just like everybody else.
Hmm.
Well, that's not true. We're not like everybody else. There are a lot of differences, and I think the idea that we're all like everybody else is part of a philosophy that doesn't really exist in this country.
Mm-hmm.
We have a dream, but we don't really. People are not all alike. People are not treated alike. And I say that from the perspective of a white man who, by being white, I have lots of privileges in this country
mm-hmm.
that blacks don't have. And I'm quite aware of it from my politics, and my husband is black. And so we've talked about this at great lengths.
I had understood that you're in an interracial marriage. I am the product of an interracial marriage. And it strikes me that that was also, when we were born, not something that our parents would have dreamt of?
No, not at all.
Do you find any similarity in the two movements?
Tremendously. I think very much of what we in the gay movement have experienced is due to the civil rights movement that's been going on for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've actually written about this and talked about it, that the feminist movement built on the civil rights movement, and there were movements long before that. Part of my thinking, and forgive me for being so political around it, but I think one of the dangers we have in this country is that we don't recognize our own history.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, many blacks don't know the history of blacks in terms of what they have been doing in the culture, as well as gays don't have a real good sense of history.
Mm-hmm. And being in the second half of life, as I put it in this podcast, do you feel that the perspective of age helps?
Age has always been kind of one of those isms that I've been focusing on for a lot of years. The way we got, you and I got connected was through Sage.
Yes, I wanted to bring that up. And tell me about Sage.
Well, Sage now stands for Services and Advocacy for Gay, Lesbian, really GLBT elders.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been involved with it almost from the very beginning, back in the 70s. Started as a small, very charismatically led organization. And I felt ageism was just something that our culture, the gay culture, just personified, even more so than the culture around it. Because I knew it as a gay man. You know, we were, how can I put it? We understood what it meant to be a sex object as well as to look on someone else as a sex object.
Mm-hmm.
Or as I would say, you know, most non-gay men didn't see themselves as a sex object, but saw women as a sex object.
Right.
Whereas two men both saw each other as sex objects. And ageism was a very, very important concept. In fact, I actually wrote a book on it, dealing with the issue of ageism and aging for gay men.
What's the title of the book?
Golden Men, The Power of Gay Midlife. But I've done also writing on the issue because I just felt that, you know, learning how to age successfully in this culture is really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when you had contacted me about, you know, this talk about sex, my thought was, you know, it's not so much, you know, are they having sex? Do they have sex? What are they doing? But do they feel desirable?
Right, yeah.
You can do the techniques, but unless sort of the feeling is there, it ain't going to be lots of fun.
Exactly. Can you tell us something about what Sage's goals are?
It's to make people aware of gay seniors and to make them aware that there are special needs because of the poverty issue, because of the living alone issue,
mm-hmm.
how gay elders are, in a sense, have different needs, mostly because of being single or don't have an extended family,
mm-hmm.
and trying to educate the population about gay needs, the gay elder needs. Which is why they're focusing on being at the White House conferences on aging.
Yes.
They've developed an incredibly important website so that anybody around the country in a small town can plug in and ask any questions around aging issues, around what's the local community center, a local SAGE organization, you know, sort of an answering and getting help to all the people around the country, as well as training institutions, you know, nursing homes, retirement homes, assisted living places, anything, any organization that deals with aging. They're trying to help educate everyone who works there to be culturally competent. So they know how to deal with with people who are LGBT and aging, or seniors, I should say.
What would you say that for you and your husband, what's your vision of growing old together and reaching end-of-life issues in terms of how society is going to support you?
Well, he's 73, I'm 79, and we've talked a lot about this. We've done our wills and our medical proxies. We both are very clear how we want end-of-life issues to be. We both feel that so much of our health depends on how we take care of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So we both are very physically active. He has his exercise routines that he does 3 times a week. I go to the gym 4 times. I'm in a senior program, Silver Sneakers programs, and I have a trainer. So we keep ourselves physically in shape. And we basically watch the way we eat. And I'm HIV positive, and I've been HIV positive since 87.
Mm-hmm.
He's not.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able actually to keep my viral load down and undetectable for years doing alternate means. And only the last couple of years did I do the cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
But we seem pretty much that we'll be there for each other and we'll just deal with the situations as they come up. We're prepared that we don't have to second guess each other's wants as to, in a sense, when to pull the plug, if it comes to that.
What concerns do we as a society need to address?
I think one of the most important is the poverty issue, that seniors, you know, are poor,
mm-hmm.
and at the bottom of the list are Black lesbians.
Yeah.
You know, being women, number one, and then being Black, number two, and then being lesbians. So right now, what we're trying to do is make people aware that when they think of gay seniors, to start thinking of the broad range, because many, many people, when you say gay, they think of white middle-class men.
Mm.
And my concern is not as much about the white middle class, financially successful gay men, but it's the people who are on the fringes of even the gay culture,
mm-hmm.
who are on the outside. And they're the ones who are not being taken care of.
If somebody wanted to, you know, take action on that issue, what can they do in their community or on a national or international level to voice their concerns?
Start asking the question of how are seniors being treated in their community.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's not the seniors who have money and can afford to go into retirement villages and retirement homes.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happening with the senior centers? It's not that all this, you know, the non-gay seniors are being treated beautifully and the gay seniors are being discriminated against. It's, you know, there are lots of non-gay seniors who are discriminated against too and not treated well. But I would literally say anybody just has to look around at what kind of senior centers there are, what kind of facilities are available, how are the programs being conducted and for whom. And it also has to deal with the issue of racism in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
Unfortunately, in most of the senior programs around the country, especially in the nursing homes, which, by the way, only get a small percentage of seniors. you know, seniors still tend to live at home or be with family.
Are there particular issues for gay and lesbian and transgender elders in these facilities?
Yes. Many are just not available to them. Mm-hmm. And if they are, especially the transgender, I mean, this is the transgender issue is becoming a very big issue now, because more and more transgendered people are becoming, in a sense, coming out of the closet, mm-hmm. and the health care for them is abysmal.
Mm-hmm.
Because many physicians and healthcare workers don't know how to deal with them. They don't know what to do.
Are you optimistic or pessimistic for the future based on what you've seen over your many years of activism?
Optimistic. I think the changes are much slower than we would like them to be.
Mm-hmm.
But there are positive changes. I mean, it's incremental.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in my young activist days, I would meet, you know, seniors who were activists, and they didn't even see me. They were looking at the generations beyond me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's, I mean, we can look at it as being, you know, the half empty glass, and things are horrible and they're not good. And of course we can point to those. But I think there have been so many more changes in the positive direction. I mean, one of the reasons I was interested in talking with you is the fact that you were willing to talk about seniors having sex. That was, you know, that was so important to me because, you know, this is obviously a discussion I have had a lot with other gay men. And what I find is gay men, by and large, don't realize that, how can I put it? As a friend of mine once said, oh, I would never have sex with someone who looked like me. Because he was always looking at younger people. And it's like, if you don't see yourself as being attractive and being desirable, then, you know, you're putting yourself in a really bad situation. Because, you know, I'll for example, walk down the street with, and this used to happen a lot when I first started becoming aware of this issue. And gay men said, see, look, I'm invisible. And I would say, what do you mean invisible? And they'd say, well, oh, these men don't look at me. And I said, have you noticed all the men who are looking at you?
Mm.
And they'd say, well, what do you mean? I said, you're noticing the people who are not looking at you,
mm-hmm.
but you're not noticing the people who are looking
mm-hmm.
at you.
Isn't that always the way?
Yeah, I said, so, you know, it's not that you're invisible. You're making invisible a lot of other people, you know. And also, I think one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this issue with you is that what makes us attractive and desirable changes as we get older.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not attractive in the way that I was when I was 20 or 30 or 40.
Mm-hmm.
I'm attractive in a very different way. And what I have to offer is something very different, as well as some of it being the same. I mean, my husband and I are in a monogamous relationship,
mm-hmm.
and we still have sex regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And I know myself, you know, I don't walk around being horny the way I used to when I was young, much younger.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, for example, I was listening to your podcast about different men talking about, you know, ED and problems they have. Well, I'm one of those people who, when I was 20, I had problems with ED.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not something that came on me all of a sudden. And I think when men are honest, they realize, you know, even when we were younger, there were areas we had difficulties with. And we have to find the ways of satisfying differently, and it's with different people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our moods are different, our responses are different.
Different, but not necessarily lesser.
Absolutely. Yes. It's definitely not lesser. You know, it's, if anything, I would say, for example, my sexual response is much, much deeper than it was in the past.
And by deeper, you mean?
I'm much more fully present.
Uh-huh.
It's not me acting a part. It's not me doing all the things that were considered hot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very much the person my husband is having sex with.
So more present. And do you feel that you wouldn't have been able to be that present as a younger person?
Oh, I definitely wasn't that present as younger.
Do you see it as an advantage of age or a personal connection with your husband?
I would say both.
Oh.
I would say it's both. It's partially who we both are, but I find as we get older, the masks drop.
Ah.
The playing the part drops. The acting as if or who we'd like to be or the image. It's you know, the old saying, you know, why is it, you know, so many men become curmudgeons as they get older? I don't think they become curmudgeons. I think it's just expressing what's always been there, but they've learned they don't keep their mouths shut. They just say what's on their mind. And I also, as a positive, I think we're also much more expressive. We're more loving. We're not so afraid of being open, of being vulnerable.
The podcast name is The Better Half. Would you say that the second half could be the better half?
I would say it definitely is. Yes. I remember when I was young and, oh, somewhere in my 20s, late 20s, and thinking, oh, the turn of the century. Oh, my God, I'm going to be 63 years old. Will I even be conscious of that year? And now I laugh because, you know, it's like, I'm literally, my life has never felt richer and more fulfilling and more contented than, I mean, it's the best it's ever been. Because when I think of myself in my teens were probably the most anxiety-ridden period, but my 20s were also.
Mm-hmm.
And I must tell you, a significant point was when I was 14, I was arrested for being gay.
Oh.
It was police entrapment, and I had been, you know, having sex for a couple of years before that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when the police call your family to announce, you know, I didn't have to come out of the closet.
Mm.
You know, I was shot out of the closet. But that changed my life because... And that's also what led me, I think, to activism, because I knew here I was, you know, the white Jewish kid who experienced the courts, the police, and I knew what it was like to live in fear and be on the other side of the law. And that gave me an understanding and an awareness that it took years to develop, but gave me to understand what it really meant to be a minority.
Thank you so much for your activism and for this conversation. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, there wasn't a lot about sex, but I think having a lot of sex or being sexual at 79 is just about being alive and living a full life.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you very much. It was very, very lovely to meet you.
Thank you. Thank you. And the same with you.
Okay, it's time for a break. A Kegel break.
Ladies, you remember what a Kegel exercise is. You were taught to do this, to squeeze your pelvic floor muscles after pregnancy. But guess what? Kegels are not just for pregnancy, not just for ladies. Want to keep from wetting yourself when you sneeze? You want to prevent UTIs, have better orgasms, stronger erections? But let's not just talk about it. Let's take a Kegel break right now. Here's a sound effect to help you visualize it as we contract our pelvic floor muscles and release. Ready? All together. Getting older isn't just about aging. It's also an accumulation of experience that can include limitations or pain. The older we are, the more likely that we are dealing with these issues, and they get in the way of spontaneity and that anything, anywhere expectation. Eva Margot Kant has a message about pretty sex and how to avoid shutting down one's sexual self when dealing with illness, pain, and disability. Eva is a clinical social worker, a sex educator, a sex psychotherapist, as well as an adjunct professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Social Service. Hello, Eva Margot Kant.
Good morning, Laura. How are you?
I'm very well. What did you want to do when you grew up?
Originally, when I grew up, I wanted to do one of three things. One is I wanted to be a doctor, to do research or psychiatry. But that was out of the question since I couldn't pass chemistry or math. The second thing, I wanted to be a lawyer and advocate in any way I could. And third, if I was to be honest and tell the world, I wanted to go into acting.
How old are you now?
Now I am 56. It's an interesting age. I transitioned careers, if you will, when I turned 40.
Interesting.
Yes. I went from the corporate world to the world of health and healing.
And that's what I want to ask you about. So there's this temptation for us as we get older to give in to illness and age, to let it shut us down. And I wanted to hear from you about that topic.
My pleasure. And it happens to be one that I'm very passionate about. And it's actually what led me to get postgraduate training in sex therapy and also couples, was to work with individuals and couples who are challenged by illness in parts of their lives, as well as some of the individuals who are aging and trying to navigate the world. I think basically what happens is society says that if you are above a certain age, or if you aren't a certain type of able-bodied or healthy individual, then we don't see you as a sexual individual. And that's not what should be important in your life, that there's some sort of time frame where feeling sexual and being sexual exists. And after a certain age, or once you get ill in any type of chronic illness, that goes away. It's like having a sexual shelf life, right?
Right.
And after the age, especially of 50 and even older, that shelf life is gone. And it's so untrue. And there's absolutely the opposite study to prove it. In fact, there was a study that couples who are together longer and continue to have sex on a regular basis feel much more connected to their partners than those who don't. And I think it's so important. And I know many women and men who are just getting out there. What is challenging, though, is the messages that we get from society and how to counteract that. Media, for example.
Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah, well, I think what happens is, you know, we get a lot of what we think exists in the world from movies and television, and what they portray, and they sort of have to for their own financial gain, is what is called pretty sex, right? So pretty sex has certain criteria. It has pretty people or people who are in a certain type of good shape or a certain age. And if they're not a certain age and they don't look a certain way, very often they're used as the comic foil, right?
Right.
It's funny to watch people who are overweight have sex. It's really not, you know? And the second thing is it's spontaneous. So if you watch a movie, and if I may take a moment to describe, and people's eyes meet, and there's all this passion, and clothes are Velcroed on. And no one's zipper gets stuck, and no one's bra is unable to be unhooked, or if it's two men, they can't unbutton the belts, or none of that. It just happens. The clothes fly off, and passion takes over, and the only mention of protection at all is basically condom is shown, perhaps, and not always, or the sentence will be, do you have protection? It's almost like a don't talk and spoil the mood. And this is what people think sex is like or intercourse is like. Mm-hmm. There's very little foreplay, if any at all, little more than there used to be. And, oh, and by the way, orgasms usually 9 times out of 10 occur at the same time and always occur. Mm-hmm. And that's Hollywood sex. And people grow up believing that is the case. And I will tell you a funny story. When I have my students, I teach graduate school at Columbia, and I teach human sexuality to social work students, and we do an entire class on aging, sexuality, and they are shocked. First of all, when I say what age is aging begin, and or seniors begin, it can start as young as 45. And what challenges them most is they're picturing, in this case, they're young, they're picturing their grandparents, right? And so they just can't deal with that. And they very often are afraid that people above 50 will break their hips or hurt themselves
right.
in doing crazy, fun, wild, passionate sex. And it's like I sit there, stand there, and I look at them, you know, and I'm over 50, and they look at me, and I'm sure they don't want to imagine me, but and they don't want to imagine their folks. So this is what starts to happen, this pretty sex, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, changing that image, what if someone has to plan sex? When you have an illness, you specifically have to schedule it so that It is around if you need to take medication or it's the best part of the day when you're feeling well. But it doesn't mean it's any less passionate. It doesn't mean it's any less pleasurable. That's the myth. It can be planned and be incredible, pleasurable. It is not always spontaneous. In fact, most of the time it really isn't, unless you're in the movies.
And how does that affect real people?
I think real people need to see themselves portrayed. It's the psyche internally needs to identify, you know, that this is possible for me. But there needs to be some sense of desire that we are desirable based on what we see or what we know. And that's not what's showing in the media. And because I think psychologically, audiences do not want to see aging or people challenged by illness or disability because of fear.
What are people afraid of when they see that?
Much to their chagrin. I use my students as sort of my experiments, you know, to get testing from it. And what they say are things like, oh my God, I don't want to look like that. You know, things drop and droop and change and modify, and that's not what they want to be. They want to see these, you know, firm bodies where everything is in the exact location it was 20 years prior, if it ever was in that location, which is what you see, for example, in porn movies with the women, you know, where everything is lifted and tucked and airbrushed. In real life, that's not what people look like. And as we age, things do shift, you know, for both men and women. A lot of people don't realize that. Men's testicle, the scrotum area, drops, right? Women's breasts, the skin gets a little thinner. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean you're not beautiful. It doesn't mean you're not strong. It just means you don't look like what Hollywood or whomever decides is the goal look.
Can we talk about pain and illness as well?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, one of the things that happens is that when you have a chronic illness, especially, or an illness that involves pain, and I work with clients with who suffer from both is that you learn to incorporate that into your life. And the first thing, it's inevitable that I hear, is that my doctor won't talk to me about how this will affect my intimate life. Mm-hmm. And who, and if they're single, or even if they're not, who will find me desirable? And they have to learn how to work within the framework of the illness and the pain and change it, change their life and their style of sex play to accommodate. But it doesn't mean that it absolutely, I'm so passionate, it does not have to go away.
Talk about some of the ways that people do that.
Okay, for example, I have a client, have had clients who deal with pain where touch, which should feel amazing and loving, can be painful. So it's to learn through self-exploration and exercises that I assign, and you can do with self or with partner, what parts of the body at any given day feel easier to touch, softer, what type of touch, things of that nature. If, for example, someone has a breathing challenge, and this is the case if you have COPD, there are certain times of the day where breathing is much freer, okay, usually midday. So you schedule your sex play during that time, and maybe certain positions facilitate deeper breaths and breathing. In the case, and I'll be graphic here, there are a number of people who have ostomy bags of varying size and nature. Mm-hmm. Yes, you plan it. Yes, you clean it out. You tape it down and you let it go and you have fun. And it's there, but I will tell you, it becomes, it's just ignored. It's just there. The same thing that people have with certain types of numbness in the body, progressive diseases at times like MS, where numbness can change at any given time, and including numbness in the vulva area for females and et cetera. But you learn to accommodate. The key is the communication piece, and that's what's missing.
Is that hard for older people?
Absolutely. You know, it's very funny. You're taught growing up, you don't talk about sex. And, you know, I'm reminded of a movie. If you remember the movie, I don't know if you saw Bullets Over Broadway, the Diane Wiest character. She kept saying, shush, don't speak to John Cusack. And it's almost like that's what we have in our minds. Don't speak. It will ruin the mood. Don't speak because you don't, you know, your fear of being judged. Ashamed. You either know too much, you don't know enough. You want to be able to speak in a way that is non-critical, which says, this feels better. I had a very young, actually, cancer patient who her life had changed because of the cancer treatment. And this is very common with cancer treatment at any age. So if you're a woman and you're in heavy chemo, you can be slammed into menopause, not gradually into menopause, slammed. If you're younger, it will come back sometimes. If you're above 45, for example, it won't. So now all of a sudden you have to deal with all the symptoms of menopause very quickly. Mm-hmm. And that includes, how do I have sexual intercourse? How do I have sex play with that? And you learn, how does that work? And how will my partner or future partner see me if I have scars or they know and all these things? So it's communicating the concerns, communicating with each other. But no one's taught that growing up, and especially certain generations, much less than even now. And that's important.
Yeah. And I hear a lot about people not knowing how to talk. What are some tools that people can use to start talking? And are men or women better at it?
You know, it's funny. We assume women are better talkers at everything. You know, in fact, you know, everyone assumes we just keep talking. I find there is just as much challenge between whether it's men or women. What I teach clients, what I call TDCs of communication, which is tone, delivery, and content. So you make time to discuss with your partner what you're feeling. It's not always easy and appropriate to discuss it at that moment in the bedroom. It may be for a future conversation. Tone, how you say it, is absolutely key. What kind of visual, looking someone in the eye, if that's at all possible. Delivery, are you delivering it while you're in the middle of making dinner? No, that's not going to work. Is there any distraction? And it also can be playfully done as well, by the way. It doesn't have to be super serious. And the content is, what are you saying? Instead of saying, would you do this and stop doing that? You're saying, I really like it when you do that. Or I really like to try this because it feels good with my body. So that's just one of the training classes I do, which is the TDCs of communication. That's, by the way, across the board. Men and women are afraid to discuss it out of shame, judgment, and fear. You know, of what it's going to come out like, what am I going to be judged as? And you're not taught how to do it. You're really not. I remember you had in one of your podcasts, a couple that's in the swinging community or lifestyle. Mm-hmm. The best communication in the sexual arena, interestingly enough, is in the polyamory community and the subcategory of the swinging community. Mm-hmm. Because there were rules, guidelines, and boundaries, and they are constantly and consistently addressed, redressed in terms of changed and modified. But that's what helps to keep jealousy and anger at bay, because it's open communication.
How about insecurity? Because when we're talking about changing bodies and pain and disability, communicating shame or embarrassment is new stuff.
The insecurity, though, the minute you change, your body changes from what you believed it to have been, it completely shakes your world, and you have to find your new way of judging yourself as beautiful, male or female, and desirable. Mm. There was a quote, if I may, Laura, and it said that intimacy of a sexual nature allows the people involved to feel desire and to feel desired. And that's key in life. In whatever you choose, you know, unless you have a certain kind of relationship and don't want sexual play, more in the asexual nature, fine. But otherwise, that to me is it.
And that's a beautiful way to end this conversation. I hope we'll talk again.
I would look forward to that. Thank you so much for allowing me to share with your listeners some of my knowledge and experience.
Since I know you gentle, genteel listeners don't make it your business to keep up on sex news, this old prude braves the internet for you and reads journals and, increasingly, receives a lot of fascinating topicry from her friends and family by email. In fact, it seems clear that the first thing my friends think of when they see something strange and sex-related is me. So here's the news, in case you missed it. Sex injury data has been released for 2009 to 2014. Lest you fear that your government doesn't care, there is, I'm not joking, a U.S. National Electronic Injury Surveillance System run by the Consumer Product Safety Commission in the U.S., and they are tracking your sexual owies. July is the most dangerous time to have sex, apparently. Most sex injuries are unreported. Word to the wise, just as it is rarely the initial mistake, but rather the cover-up that causes the most damage, if you make poor choices with objects, it's best to go to the emergency department early, because it's the waiting that causes most of the injuries. But, and this surprises me, there were no fatal sexual injuries during that whole period of time. Folks, you're not trying hard enough. Here's a new search term for you. Faux-cest, as in fake, and incest. It's a growing subgenre for pornography, and especially popular, apparently, with women who prefer a storyline to their entertainment. I'm sorry not to fail sex positivity about anyone's turn-ons, but this is not funny or sexy. I hope you enjoyed Leap Day, February 29th, which we only let happen once every 4 years, and I bet you didn't know that it's also called Bisextus, which sounds like a high-tech fun time. You'll be interested to know that Israel will have its first transsexual beauty contest, which is not progress. Objectifying bodies and rating people's attractiveness is harassment, not achievement.
You'll remember earlier in the podcast when Eva mentioned what I hear a lot, that earlier in the day is better for sex as you get older. The Kinsey Institute, which really was and still is a thing, agrees. But they say that for men, the morning peak is 6 a.m., and for women is between 8 and 10 a.m., which is awkward, unless you're both the same gender, but may work if different sex partners start at 6 and want to make a full morning of it. You'll be relieved, as I was, to learn that having sex with animals is still against the law in Germany, though it boggles my mind why changing that law was entertained. Though, if you do forget yourself and have sex with a goat in Sudan, you may have to pay a dowry to its owner. True story. Thank you for listening to episode 9 of Our Better Half. Before you go, I'm going to make you an offer that you will not want to refuse. A free subscription to the OMG Yes website. The owners of the site are giving one lucky listener a subscription to episode 1 on this site, which is a virtually hands-on tutor on how to bring happiness to a vulva you love, your own or someone else's. One of the OMG Yes's founders will be interviewed on the show next week. But if you'd like to be in the drawing for the subscription or find out more, go to ourbetterhalf.net and click on the on button. Old people, I've talked to you about this. It's a good day for an orgasm. Yours. Listen in next week.